Well, this is Easter Sunday 2015, and today I'm going to do a slightly different talk. This is taken from chapter 11 of book 1, How to Become a Christian, which can be downloaded on the Real Christianity website. What I'm going to do is take this chapter, which is entitled Proof That the Resurrection Really Happened. And it's a lengthy chapter with a lot of scriptures in it. I'm not going to read all the scriptures because there's so many. But I've assembled in that chapter, not all, but most of the verses that touch upon the resurrection. So it's been gathered together as a study, which I recommend people look at. And the reason I put this chapter together within the book on how to become a Christian is because it's absolutely imperative that a person believe in the resurrection. Well, first of all, it's imperative that there have been a resurrection. If there wasn't one, then what we believe in is all a complete waste of time and means nothing and is all false and we're going nowhere and the entirety of Christianity is untrue. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, the whole thing is meaningless and false. That's how fundamental it is. So his resurrection, his physical resurrection, isn't just an additional, optional extra if you go for it, if you want it. It's foundational to the whole thing. And Paul speaks of this in 1 Corinthians 15. I won't read it all out, but he says in 1 Corinthians 15, 12 to 23, he speaks of, if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. Then he goes on to say, and if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. And then in verse 19, if only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men. And then he goes on to speak of how Jesus is the first fruits of the resurrection, and we are the eventual remainder of that. So what happened to him is going to happen to us. We're going to be resurrected, just like him, and have resurrection bodies. So this question then of how do we know the resurrection happened, I want to go through it, examining the evidence for it, considering the evidence. And so someone might say, well, surely there's no evidence for it now, it's 2,000 years ago, there can't be any evidence. But actually there is. In fact, there's an enormous amount of evidence for it. And I speak as a person whose whole professional life has really focused upon this issue of a subject of evidence. When I was in the police, when I was a lawyer, everything revolved around gathering, evaluating, assembling, judging evidence. And I've adopted the identical approach to this question that I did when I was doing commercial litigation or dealing with criminal cases or whatever. The evidence for the resurrection is overwhelming. In fact, it's absolutely incontrovertible. This is the point. So the thing is, although Christianity is a faith, and although we are to have faith in Jesus Christ, I don't think that his resurrection is even a matter of faith. It's a matter of simple fact. It goes beyond faith in the sense of trusting in it. It's a certainty, and the evidence is so strong that you can say that. And I hope to be able to attempt to prove that today. So there are others who've done this in the past, and there's a man called Frank Morrison back in the 1920s. He was an unbeliever, and he set out to disprove the resurrection. He was going to write a book showing that it never happened. Can't have happened, can't possibly have happened. So off he went to write this book, and in the process of doing so, as he assembled the evidence, he was overwhelmed by it, and he found himself building a sort of massive case against his own case. And in the end, he became a Christian, and he ended up writing a book called Who Moved the Stone, which is a proof of the resurrection. So there's an irony for you. And so his book is a very good book, and it's still in print now, nearly 100 years later. So let's go through a number of things and examine the evidence. I'm not going to read out all the verses, but what I will do, for the sake of the tape as well, is mention the references for most of them, because then a person who wants to can look them up. But alternatively, just check out the website, because they're all listed there in chapter 11 of book 1. So one of the first extracts I give is a lengthy one from Luke. It's essentially the whole of chapter 24 of Luke. And interestingly, in that, you'll notice here and elsewhere that the first witnesses of the resurrection were women. Mm. Now, does anyone see significance in that? Why did God arrange, because everything was arranged, why did he arrange for women to be the first witnesses of the resurrection? Think about it. Under the Jewish legal system, women's evidence counted for much less. Now, that's not a biblical thing, that's just their thing. So before anyone says, oh, that's what the Bible says, no, it doesn't. That's what their system said. So their system said that men's evidence counted for a lot, when women's evidence counted for much less. Now, in that setting, God deliberately arranged that women would be the first witnesses. Now, if you were setting up a hoax, if you were the apostle setting up a hoax, why would you have your very first witnesses in this elaborate hoax being people whose evidence would not be accepted? Do you see? So I'll just throw that in, because one of the things we're going to examine today is the resurrection all a hoax set up by the apostles when it wasn't true? Well, if you were going to explore that, but just this one point, if it was a hoax, that is not the way I would go about perpetrating a hoax. If I was perpetrating a hoax, I would get men to be the first witnesses. I would not make the mistake of having women as the first witnesses. But that's what Jesus did. And remember, this isn't his idea that women evidence counts for less. It was their idea, the system's idea, which he was defying. But also to make that point. So read the whole of Luke chapter 24. And then there are extracts from Matthew. These are things that touch upon the resurrection. Matthew 28, 8 to 15. Mark 16, 9 to 16. John 20, 19 to 31.
Can you just say Mark again?
Yeah, Mark is 16, yeah. 9 to 16. What I'll do now is take us through these arguments. We're going to look at arguments for and against the resurrection, but I want to particularly focus, structure this in terms of the arguments against it. So we'll examine the arguments against it and evaluate those. Because we do have to consider the alternatives. What are the alternatives? And what I think you'll conclude at the end of this is that every single possible alternative explanation for the resurrection is impossible. Not only implausible or unlikely, but absolutely ridiculous. Every single one of them. And now the first alternative explanation is, did Jesus' disciples steal his body from the tomb and invent the whole story of the resurrection? Now that false allegation goes back to the very beginning. That's the rumour that the Jewish officials spread. They put it about deliberately as a rumour to try to explain away what happened. But they themselves knew that it was a lie. Now we can prove that that's a lie in many ways. The first question to look at is, if that was true, firstly, how could the disciples have got past the guards? Now when you see in children's books or little pictures the guards outside Jesus' tomb, what do you see? You just see a couple of soldiers there, don't you? Private Pike and Private Godfrey standing outside the tomb, and that's all you've got. That's not how it was. Now the guard that was placed on the tomb, bear in mind Jesus was a very important public figure. He was the most famous person in the country. And the Jewish authorities and the Roman governor were afraid that there was going to be trouble after his death. In fact, we're going to see later, they had not forgotten that he had promised that he would be resurrected. They had not forgotten that. The disciples had forgotten that. But ironically, they had not forgotten this. They were expecting there was going to be talk of him rising from the dead. They also thought that his disciples might come and take his body. So they posted a guard outside the tomb. But when we say a guard, we don't mean a couple of chaps. We mean an entire group of probably 50, 60 to 100 men, at least, guarding the tomb. You know, 3, 4, 5 platoons of men guarding this tomb. And so, if the disciples were to go and steal Jesus' body, they would have had to get past the guards. Now, how would they get past the guards? One possibility is they overpowered the guards. All right. But if they had overpowered the guards would have seen them. The guards would have seen the disciples coming, and they'd have said afterwards, "We were overpowered by the apostles and the various disciples who came with them. You know, there were only 2 or 3 of us, and they overpowered us." They'd have said so. That's not what they said. Remember what was said? The rumour put about, because the soldiers, the authorities knew. They knew that the soldiers were telling the truth. They knew what had happened. They saw the angel. They saw what happened. They saw it. They were not put to death. Now, if they had allowed Jesus' body to be stolen, they'd have been put to death. The authorities looked after them and promised them they'd be all right. And they did that because they knew that they'd done nothing wrong. They knew that Jesus' body hadn't been stolen. They knew that the guards had not fallen asleep. But what did they do? The authorities told the guards, "We'll look after you. You put the story out that you fell asleep and the disciples came while you were asleep." Now, has anyone's IQ high enough to spot a flaw in this argument? They are saying, "The disciples came while we were asleep." And that's the sort of lie that a 4-year-old tells you, isn't it? If you were asleep, how do you know who came? When you say that to your 4-year-old, when they tell you, "It wasn't me, so-and-so came while I was asleep and took the biscuits." Oh, I see. "Who was it that came while you were asleep?" "It was so-and-so." "I see. How do you know it was him?" And then there'd be, ah, wouldn't there? Now, the point is, this is the thing. They were told to say that the disciples came while we were asleep and took the body. That was the best they could think of. But anyway, quite apart from that point about it being silly, it's a child's lie that a child would tell. Guards of soldiers don't go to sleep outside tombs at night when they've been told to guard them. These are professionals, and they don't go to sleep. Now, you can imagine one chap going to sleep, not 100 men going to sleep. There was supposed to be a guard. It wasn't a girl's sleepover outside the tomb. This was a guard. And that's an impossibility. So, we can rule that out. Second point. If the resurrection was invented as a false story, remember, this is the thesis we're examining. Did the apostles steal the body? If they did, and the resurrection is a false story, not a mistake, a fabrication, that means all the apostles were liars. They weren't mistaken. This is that we're going to come on to mistaken later. At the moment, we're examining the apostles being deliberate liars. They're pretending that Jesus has risen from the dead. The question then is, what about the subsequent ministries of these men? So all 11 of the apostles, plus the disciples around them, plus a multitude of others who saw Jesus, all went on to have ministries. They all went on, many of them went on, to write letters in the New Testament and Gospels and so forth. 10 of the surviving apostles were executed for their testimony. The 11th, which was John, wasn't executed. He died of old age. But he was persecuted repeatedly in his life, imprisoned, persecuted, and they attempted to kill him. All for saying that Jesus had risen from the dead. Now, why would you make a thing up and then go to your death refusing to recant, refusing to deny it? Why would you give up your career as a fisherman and go all over the Roman Empire preaching a thing that you knew you'd made up. You can understand someone doing it for a prank in a university dormitory and keeping the prank going for a weekend or so. But why would you start a prank in a university dormitory and then spend the rest of your life, giving your whole life to telling people about the prank that you've played and go to your death for the prank? Can you see a flaw in that? That's not a possibility. And in Acts 5, we see a number of verses here about the apostles immediately after the resurrection. And Peter and John are being flogged and so forth. And the authorities, the Sanhedrin, are saying to them, "We gave you strict orders not to teach in this name." And Peter and the other apostles replied, "We must obey God rather than men. The God of our fathers raised Jesus from the dead, whom you had killed by hanging him on a tree." And then it says in verse 32, "We are witnesses of these things." He goes on. And then in verse 40, "His speech persuaded them. They called the apostles in and had them flogged. Then they ordered them not to speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. The apostles left the Sanhedrin rejoicing because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name." And it says, "Day after day in the temple courts and from house to house, they never stopped teaching and proclaiming the good news that Jesus is the Christ." Now this is immediately after the resurrection, very shortly after the ascension. This is what they're doing. They're willing to be flogged for it, willing to go out disobeying the Sanhedrin, willing to die for it. So that's their immediate thing. So if this was a prank, don't you think the joke would have worn off a bit by now? We're about 6 or 7 weeks after the resurrection. Don't you think they'd have said, "Come on, enough's enough. This is getting a bit silly now."
And all 11 of them.
All 11.
There wasn't any dissenters.
There were no dissenters. There was no one saying, "Hey, enough's enough. So at any point, at that time, and over the next 40 or 50 years, as they pursued their ministries, under torture, under persecution, somebody eventually would have said, "All right, we made it all up. Don't execute me." But nobody did. They all went to their deaths, insisting that they saw Jesus risen from the dead. Alright, well, point C under this question of, did the disciples steal the body? What about the subsequent writings? If you look at the letters written by these men, now bear in mind we're examining this hypothesis that they are fraudsters. If you examine the letters they wrote, the books they wrote, do they look to you like men of bad character? Do they look like deceitful hoaxers? Liars. They would have to be deliberately devious and dishonest, not in a small thing, not what you might call a little white lie, saying that you thought someone's dress looked nice when actually you didn't think it looked nice. We're not talking about that. We're talking about making up a hideous lie and lying to people all over the country and all over the world about it for decades. How could such a person write those letters? Do you see? How could they do it? It would be impossible for men of that wickedness to write such wonderful letters as the New Testament has in it, and the Gospels. So, whatever we might say about whether the resurrection happened, the point is, they believed it happened. They believed that Jesus rose from the dead. There's no question of that. The disciples did. Alright, point D. What about the subsequent physical appearances of Jesus to many different people? Now remember, Jesus did not only appear to the apostles. He appeared to multitudes. We don't even know how many. But lots and lots and lots of people he appeared to. Now every single one of them would have to be a liar too. And many, many of those were persecuted and executed for saying that they saw him and believing in him. Every single one of them would have to be a liar, and every single one of them would have to be willing to die for that lie, in addition to the apostles. So remember, Jesus didn't just appear briefly after the resurrection. He spent 40 days on the earth after the resurrection, before the ascension, during which he was actively engaged in preaching and teaching and and explaining and showing and directing the disciples for what comes next. He gave them much preparation in those 40 days and appeared to vast numbers. And we know from 1 Corinthians 15:5 that he appeared on one particular occasion to more than 500 people at the same time. So we're talking on that, just that one occasion, there were more than 500 on that one occasion. Now, we don't know how many other times he appeared to large numbers, but on that occasion he appeared to more than 500. Now, how could all of that many people perpetrate this lie and keep doing so? And how could they, if you say, well, maybe they were hallucinating or something, how could they all hallucinate? How could they all hallucinate simultaneously and have the same hallucination? Why didn't some of them, imagine they'd all had LSD in their tea, someone had slipped LSD into the tea. Well, if that was the case, some would be seeing tangerine trees, some would be seeing marmalade skies, some would be seeing Lucy in the sky, wouldn't they? They wouldn't all be seeing the same thing, would they? They'd all be seeing their own different things. They all saw the same thing at the same time, and they all carried on saying afterwards that they'd seen him. Okay, so let's examine, because let's pursue this, because you need to get hold of the fact that vast numbers of people saw Jesus alive over 40 days. It was not a one-off. So I'm going to list them briefly. I give the references, but I won't read them all out. So these are the people who saw Jesus alive. Number one, two women outside of Jerusalem, probably Mary Magdalene and another Mary. And this is in Matthew 28, 9 and 10. Number two, Mary Magdalene on her own. This is in John 20, 15 to 18. She sees him. Number three, two travellers on the road to Emmaus. Now they spend the whole journey talking to Jesus, and he explains the prophecies in the Bible to them. Number four, Peter when he's in Jerusalem. This is in Luke 24, 34. The previous one, Emmaus, was in Luke 24. And then number five, the 10 disciples in the upper room. Now each of the things I'm speaking of here are separate incidents. We're not looking at different accounts of the same incident. So there's 10 disciples in the upper room. This is in John 20, 19 to 25. And then the next occasion, there's 11 disciples in the upper room. And this is in John 20, 26 to 31. This is the same group, but this time with Thomas present. It's a separate occasion, and it's a week later. So the LSD will have worn off by now, won't it? This is a point, it's not a single event. This is a separate week later when they all see him again. Number seven, there were seven disciples fishing by the Sea of Tiberias, and it names them. And Jesus says, throw out your net on the other side of the boat, and they catch 153 fish. It goes through the whole thing. They actually encountered him for some time and spoke to him, and he helped them with the fishing, and then he had breakfast with them. This is a separate occasion. Now these fellows are going to have to be pumping LSD into themselves for the whole 40 days, aren't they? And having simultaneous identical hallucinations throughout the whole time. Number 8. 11 disciples on the mountain in Galilee. And that is in Matthew 28, 16 to 20. Next, in number 9, he appeared to more than 500 people, to James, and also some years later to the Apostle Paul. Now, this is described in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 to 8. So there are three different things spoken of here. There's the meeting with 500 people. Secondly, separate point, the meeting with James. Third point, some years later, Jesus met with the Apostle Paul. Those are all spoken of in 1 Corinthians 15. Totally separate occasions. I should mention, Paul saw Jesus on many occasions, not just on the road to Damascus. Many occasions. So number 10, the disciples who watched Jesus ascending into heaven. Remember, they saw that happening as well. And that's shown in Luke 24, and also in Acts 1, 3 to 8. So in addition to all of these, there must have been many others which aren't referred to in the Bible. Because all we've got in the Bible, I say all, we've got about, well, I've just listed 10, and I'm going to list some more in a minute. But there's those, but those are the ones that are listed. There must be many more, because he was there for 40 days. And imagine how much of a kerfuffle this must have caused in the local church. People must have been talking about this continually, arranging to meet, turning up. You know, they've heard that Jesus is down by the lake. People would have been flooding down to the lake, and then they hear that he's somewhere else, they'd have flooded over there, and so forth. And he was in different parts of Israel, sometimes in Galilee, sometimes in Jerusalem, do you see? The people would have known, and they would have come down and seen, and passed on the word. So let's look at another one, 11. Apostle Paul's first encounter with Jesus. It was a few years later. Now this is not, you might say, well, maybe there was some kind of mass hysteria taking place in Jerusalem at the time. But this is a few years later, and Paul, who is an enemy of Jesus, an enemy of the apostles, is miles away, years later, and he meets Jesus on the road to Damascus. And that's spoken about in Acts chapter 9. Some people assume that's the only time that Paul ever met Jesus. Bear in mind, Paul met and spent more time with Jesus, quite probably, than the apostles did. And I'll explain why in a minute. But in number 12, Apostle Paul's face-to-face meeting with Jesus Christ when he received the gospel from him. And this is spoken of in 1 Corinthians 9 and also in Galatians 1, 11 to 12. And it says in 1 Corinthians 9, "Have I not seen Jesus our Lord?" And then it says in Galatians 1, 11 to 12, "For I would have you know, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man, for I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ." Jesus Christ met with Paul and told him the gospel to himself face to face. He did not receive it from the apostles. This is why Paul is entitled to call himself an apostle, because he heard it from Jesus' own mouth afterwards. And perhaps, who knows how long for? He may have spent, while only a second was going by on earth, Paul might have been in heaven for years hearing from Jesus. Who knows? We're not told. 13. Apostle Paul seeing and speaking with Jesus whilst in a trance. This is spoken of in Acts 22, 17 to 21. And he says, "It happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I fell into a trance, and I saw him saying to me, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me.' And I said, 'Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another I used to imprison and beat those who believed in you,'" and so forth. And it says, "And he said to me, 'Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles.'" And Jesus is with him speaking. This is years later. Now, someone might say, well, maybe Paul's making it up. Well, try reading Paul's letters. Read the whole of his letters. Does he sound like a man who's a liar, who makes things up? Does he sound like a fantasist and hallucinator? No, he doesn't. 14. This is a big one. Apostle Paul was caught up into heaven. He went to the third heaven, where he was given a direct revelation and was told many things. And he speaks of this in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, 1 to 9. And this is where Paul explains why he was given a thorn in the flesh. He was given a thorn in the flesh to keep him humble because of the enormity of the revelation given to him. Now, part of that revelation was going to heaven and meeting Jesus in heaven. Now, he had all sorts of things explained to him there. And he says, "I was caught up into paradise and heard inexpressible words which a man is not permitted to speak." Okay? So he saw and heard things he wasn't even allowed to talk about. But he was shown those things to enable his own ministry to succeed. And who knows how long he was there for, we don't know. But long enough to be told many things. So a period of time, not a moment. Perhaps a very long period. 15. Apostle John's meeting with Jesus about 60 years later. Now bear in mind, we're now talking 6 decades later. The same man, Apostle John, who met Jesus after the resurrection, met him again. And he writes about it in the book of Revelation. Now John sees Jesus himself there, face to face. He sees him actually in his glory. So he sees him in a glorified condition. Because although the apostles saw Jesus on the earth after the resurrection, they saw him in a resurrection body, but even then Jesus was turning the volume down, turning the settings down on his glory. He wasn't appearing in his glorified condition at that time. But he appeared to John in his glorified condition. And that's why when John saw him, remember, he fell down at his feet. He was afraid of him when he saw Jesus the way he really is. But the operative point is, he saw him 60 years later. And that's written about in Revelation chapter 1, 12 to 19. He speaks of that. And the whole book is what Jesus reveals to him. That's why it's called the Revelation. So we're not speaking of a small group of people who fleetingly saw Jesus, who might have got it wrong, who might have been mistaken, who might have been lying, who might have been deranged. This is way, way beyond that, exponentially beyond that. So, if the resurrection was a fraud, the people who would have known best and quickest and clearest that it was a fraud would have been the people in Jerusalem. That's where it was happening. They knew. They would have known better than anyone. And they would have been well placed to disprove it. So if this was a fraud, they would simply go to the tomb, bring out the dead body of Jesus. And there's the end of the news story. The rumour is squashed. Alternatively, virtually everybody in Jerusalem would have had a neighbour or a relative or a friend who was part of this. So if it's a hoax, then virtually everybody in Jerusalem has got a neighbour or a relative or a friend who's part of the hoax. Some of those people, late one night, after they've had a few drinks, would have admitted it was a hoax and said, look, we made the whole thing up. I'm just telling you privately, but please be aware, the whole thing was made up. That didn't happen. The church in Jerusalem grew enormously in these weeks after the resurrection, because they were seeing Jesus, because they were meeting him. And if it had been a hoax, it would have been exposed as a hoax. Nobody confided in their friends or relatives that it was a hoax. Okay. Now, let's look at alternative explanation number 2. Let's imagine it wasn't the apostles, therefore, who stole the body. Imagine that you've been completely beaten to a pulp by that argument, counter-argument, and now you abandon that argument and think, okay, well, I'll concede that. Maybe it wasn't the apostles who stole the body. What if it was the Jewish or the Roman authorities who stole the body? Now, we're actually going downhill in terms of sense. This is absolutely ridiculous. But nonetheless, let's go through it. First point to make. Let's imagine that it was the Roman or Jewish authorities who stole the body. Firstly, why would they do it? They can only lose by doing this. They've got nothing to gain and everything to lose. Think about it. Why did they put a guard outside his tomb? To stop the body being taken, to stop him resurrecting. They knew that he'd resurrected people. So they knew he'd done that. They'd heard of these things. Remember, the Jewish authorities had followed Jesus everywhere he went. He had, basically, MI5 following him everywhere he went, recording everything he did. Not just his own followers, but the Pharisees. Have you ever wondered, why does Jesus always seem to say things to Pharisees when he's speaking? The answer is, because there were Pharisees there at the side of the meeting. They were always there. And why were they there? Because the Sanhedrin because the authorities wanted to keep an eye on him. Now they saw him raise people from the dead. They saw him do it. They also knew that he had said he was going to rise from the dead. They had not forgotten it, whereas the disciples had. Now, you put a guard outside his tomb and then you steal his body? When you put the guard there to prevent anyone else doing it, and then you do it yourself. So why would they do it? It has no possible benefit to them. So it would enhance the reputation of Jesus by creating a false rumour that he's risen from the dead. And it's the very thing they were seeking to prevent anyone else doing. Okay, but nevertheless, imagine that the authorities, either Roman or Jewish, had had a mental spasm and had done that for some inexplicable reason. If they had, the other group that didn't steal the body would have exposed it, so that if the Romans did it, the Jews would have said the Romans took it. If the Jews took it, the Romans would have said the Jews took it. They'd have exposed it immediately afterwards. But let's imagine that, leave that to one side. Third point, even if either the Jewish authorities or the Roman authorities had stolen the body, let's imagine they'd had a completely ridiculous idea to do this, thinking it would help. But a day or two later, they'd have thought, goodness me, this is a very stupid thing we've done. We've now increased the reputation of Jesus. We've got everybody excited. They're all thinking he's risen from the dead. We know he hasn't, because we've got his body hidden over in another place. It seemed a good idea at the time for some reason, but now we realise it was an absurd idea to do this. What we'll do is take the body and display it in the centre of Jerusalem and have people file past and take a look at his dead body. And then we'll squash the rumour. And say, here's the body, we had it all along, it was us, we took it. Now wouldn't they do... Don't you think if they could have done that, they would have done that? So if they'd taken the body, they would have done that. But they didn't do that. They made up the silly story that it was the disciples who took the body while we were asleep. That's the best they could come up with. Okay, alternative explanation number three. This is an absolutely ridiculous one. As they all are, really, but this is excels in that area. This is called a swoon theory. And what this is it's a half-hearted idea that people put forward. And this is the idea that Jesus didn't die at all. And what happened was he sort of swooned, and he was just sort of like a Jack Bauer. He looked dead, but he wasn't actually. And although he'd been crucified and flogged and had a crown of thorns, and although he'd been stabbed with a spear, that somehow he actually wasn't dead and was just fainted and then came to later. And that was wrongly interpreted as resurrection. Okay, let's examine it, even though it's ridiculous. Well, first of all, number one, we know that he died because the Romans made sure of it. And the Romans, if they were expert at one thing, it was killing people. They knew how to kill people, and they knew when people were dead. They weren't inexpert in this, and they knew what they were talking about. And when they examined Jesus on the cross, they knew they did not need to break his legs because he was already dead. They used to break the victim's legs if they were taking a long time dying, because they needed to get off. Maybe they needed to finish it. So they break the legs so they would die in a couple of minutes. But when they examined him, they didn't bother to break his leg because they knew he was dead. Nevertheless, so first of all, they knew he was dead. But nevertheless, they still plunged a spear into his very heart. Okay? We know that because of what happened. But in addition to that, he was flogged beforehand, mercilessly. And the flogging that he got, most people didn't get that before a crucifixion. It's one of the reasons why he died quicker than other people, because he was so damaged before he even went on the cross. In addition to all that, his wrists and his feet were nailed onto the wood, and then he had to struggle in agony for hours, compounding those wounds in his ankles as he tried to breathe, because every time he tried to breathe, he had to lift himself by putting weight on his ankles. So the wounds in his ankles would have been seriously aggravated. Not only was there a 6-inch nail driven through both ankles, but then he had to put weight on them hundreds and hundreds of times. So imagine the wounds in his ankles. Okay? Now how could anybody survive all of that? Alright, well let's, you know, we're into hypothesis territory. Let's imagine that somehow he did survive all that. Alright, well if he did, how could he recover? So this man who's had all these things done to him, his back has been torn apart by flogging, the whole of his back was just a mass of wounds, and the side of him, and even the front of him, was a mass of wounds. He'd had his beard pulled out, he'd had nails through his ankles and hands, he'd had a spear in his heart. Alright, how does he recover from this? Not only how does he recover, but how does he then recover and overpower 60 to 100 Roman soldiers and get out of the tomb? So he pushes aside the stone, which is designed to secure the tomb, but nevertheless he pushes it to one side, comes out and fights a complete company of soldiers and overpowers them. And also, if somehow he did, why didn't they say so? Why didn't they say he came out and overpowered us? They didn't say that, did they? Not what they said. Alright. But let's imagine somehow he did. So, okay, we go another step. If he managed to get out and recover and get out of the tomb and get past the guard, how did he revive sufficiently to look strong and healthy enough to convince hundreds or even thousands of people that he was resurrected, that he was the Son of God, and that he was all the things he said he was? And if that's not ridiculous enough, how did he manage to go for a brisk walk for several miles to Emmaus on ankles that were wrecked by the bones being broken with the nails going through them? How did he manage that? This person, if such a person, could ever survive these things, would be in intensive care, wouldn't they? There's nobody who's had these things done to them would be anywhere except in an intensive care unit. They would not be walking to Emmaus giving Bible studies. Do you see? And then this is the clincher. Even if all those things were somehow true, it would mean that Jesus himself was a liar and a hoaxer and wasn't what he said he was and was just a fraud. Okay? So that's the swoon theory for you. Now, apart from those things, it's a great theory. So, but that's the point. That's how ridiculous it is. And yet people seriously put it forward. Alright, alternative explanation number 4. And this is even getting more ridiculous now. This is that the women ran to the wrong tomb. Notice how they blame the women. They say they went to the wrong tomb. See? Okay, let's imagine the women ran to the wrong tomb. And people seriously put this forward, thinking this somehow answers the problem. Let's imagine the women went to the wrong tomb and found it empty. And then they got excited and got excitable, and they thought he must have risen, because look, here's an empty tomb. That means this is the right tomb and he's not in it, so he must have risen. Let's get excited. Let's start waving our arms and running around. Now, that's the idea. But let's imagine that these hysterical women had done this. What would you do if you had your IQ was at least in double figures? What would you then do? You'd say, these women are saying that Jesus has risen from the dead. They're saying he's not in his tomb. Let's go to the tomb and check. Now, if that didn't occur to the apostles, would it have occurred to the Roman and Jewish authorities to go and check? I think it would. So what they'd have done is, at some point, somebody would have gone to the right tomb and said, hang on a minute, calm down, you just went to the wrong tomb. So the rumour would have lasted about 20 minutes, wouldn't it? Let's be generous, maybe it would have lasted a couple of hours, and then someone would have disproved it. Either the apostles would have done so, or the others, the Romans, the Jews, would have disproved it. So that's the running to the wrong tomb idea. I think we can dispense with that. Alternative explanation number 5 is that it's all an hallucination. Now, we've mentioned this before, but you can imagine one person hallucinating, but you cannot imagine hundreds of people on different days for 40 days and subsequently for years afterwards, Paul, John, and so forth, all hallucinating in identical ways, consistently. How is that going to happen? So you can't explain it by one person's hallucination or a hysterical person at the side of the tomb. We're talking not just in the heat of the moment, but weeks later, years later. So the idea that everybody's hallucinating simply, it doesn't even get off the ground. Okay, well, let's look at some other, one or two other thoughts. What about this as an idea? What if there just isn't a Jesus at all? The whole thing's made up. So the apostles themselves even made up this person called Jesus. There is no such person called Jesus. He never existed. The whole thing's just made up. Well, that doesn't hold water either, because the existence of Jesus Christ is a historical fact that any serious person will admit. There's more evidence historically for his existence than there is for Julius Caesar's existence. Well, how many people go around refusing to admit that Julius Caesar existed? Or any of the other famous people of that time? But there's far more evidence that Jesus existed than that Caesar existed. Far more. And I'm not talking about the Bible, I'm talking about historical records, other historians, most notably Josephus. Now, Josephus was a Jew, but not a Christian, and he worked for the Romans as a historian for the Romans. That's why he wrote his books on the Jewish wars and so forth. Now, Josephus wrote about Jesus and about what was happening in the early church, and he writes about him as a historical figure, and he's not his supporter. He's not his follower. So therefore, you come, in conclusion, to the inescapable conclusion that the bodily resurrection really did happen. And I have studied this for years and can't find any other alternative explanations to give to you. All the ones, I've picked all the best ones. These are the best. There's nothing else. And so the things I've put forward are the arguments that people put forward against the crucifixion. These are the best they can come up with. And if there were any others, I'd tell you about them. And so, if the resurrection is true, which it is, then what Jesus said is true. If what Jesus said is true, then we've got a problem. Because we're sinners, we need to be saved, we need to follow him. We need to do as he said. Because if what he says is true, then he is the Son of God and is God, and we are going to be judged by him and need to get right with him. So if the resurrection is true, it doesn't end there. That's just your starting point. It gives you a series of important obligations that, and conclusions that flow from that. I'll just mention it also that everybody was surprised by the resurrection, but they shouldn't have been, because Jesus told them many, many times he was going to rise from the dead. I won't give them all to you, but here are some of the references. In Luke 9, 20-22, Mark 8, 31-33, Mark 9, 31-32, Luke 18, 31-34, Matthew 17, 1-9, Matthew 17, 22-23, Matthew 27, 62-66. In all these times, and probably more, Jesus told him he was going to rise from the dead. But they were somehow surprised when he did. And they weren't expecting it, whereas the Romans and the Jews were. Interesting. I'll just mention one other point, just to conclude. The difference between resurrection and resuscitation. Now, resurrection is not the same as resuscitation. What happened to Lazarus, the brother of Mary and Martha, what happened to the daughter of Jairus, the 12-year-old girl, that was resuscitation. What does that mean? It means that their mortal bodies came back to life and later on died again. So they came back to life in a mortal body and died later. That's resuscitation. That's what happened to them. That's not what happened to Jesus. He was resurrected. That's why he's called the first fruits. He's the first person ever to be resurrected, not resuscitated. Even in the Old Testament, some people were resuscitated by people like Elijah and so on. That's not what happened here. So he was resurrected, meaning he received a new, permanent, eternal, indestructible resurrection body. And that's what we're going to get. It won't be a mortal body. It's not going to be this body brought back to life. It's going to be a new body that's eternal. One last point, the ascension. So 40 days after he rose, Jesus then ascended into heaven. So they actually saw him going up into heaven. They all saw that as well. So quite apart from seeing him after his resurrection, they saw him ascend into heaven. Now how do you make a mistake about that? You can hardly get confused when a group of you see Jesus rise into the heavens and go into the sky. They saw it happen and they were stone cold sober and wrote about it. So essentially then, that's the evidence for the resurrection. I remember when I was 19, I studied this because I wanted to know, how do I know it's true? I studied this at length and there came a single day when I finally realised this is true. And because I'm such a logical person, I thought, well, if this is true, I've got to act upon it. I can't just believe a thing and not act on it. I've got to act on it. I've got to change. So when I realised the resurrection really happened, that's when I started to study the Bible more seriously. What do I need to do about it? So if anyone's listening to this on tape, make the same decision. What do you need to do about it? Repent, believe, be saved. Because you're going to be judged by the very same person, Jesus, that rose from the dead and ascended into heaven. He's waiting there to come back and to judge every one of us, which is why we need to get right with him. Okay, that's that.